Australia's military history is more than just a collection of dates and the locations of war-ravaged battlefields. It is the stories of service and sacrifice of those who have answered the call of their country of birth or adoption and the enduring legacy they have created. Join me as we look into one of those stories. I'm your host, Ross Manuel, and welcome to I Was Only Doing My Job, Australia's Military History, a Doc Network podcast. Now let's get started. G'day friends and welcome to episode 58 of the podcast, recorded on the 7th of March 2024. This episode is special in that it was actually requested by the descendant of the subject, Commander Richard Stanley Veal. So a quick shout out to Doug Veal for bringing this remarkable man to the podcast's attention. As always, be sure to check out the podcast Ko-Fi store and pick up the awesome Armored Emu Brigade morale patch as they are selling like hotcakes, so get yours before they run out. And before I continue, a special acknowledgement to Matt, our newest fan. Thank you for your support for the work being done here. Now, with that out of the way, let's get started with the Australian who ordered the first shot fired in anger in both the First and Second World Wars. Richard Stanley Veal was born on the 5th of September 1893 in Lefroy, Tasmania. He was one of four children to Richard, a miner, and Laura Veal. Not long after his birth, the family moved to Victoria, moving around the state from Albert Park to Bendigo, in time for the birth of Arthur Veal in 1895 and Dulcie in 1898. By all accounts, Veal, who was known by friends and family as Stan, was drawn to the sea, brought on by visits to his grandmother in Albert Park and witnessing of naval contingents of the Victorian colony departing Port Melbourne to participate in the conflicts of the late 19th century. The Victorian naval contingent departing for their involvement in the Boxer Rebellion in 1899, and the Victorian and later Commonwealth contingents of troops departing for the Second Anglo-Boer War from 1899 to 1901. He also fondly recalled standing on the shore watching in amazement as the Victorian ironclad monitor HMVS Cerberus performing drill and manoeuvres in the bay. By 1903, the family had moved to Kalgoorlie, Western Australia, in time for the birth of the fourth Veal sibling, a sister, Lila. On the 30th of April 1909, at the age of 15, Veal joined the Australian Naval Cadet Corps as part of the Commonwealth Naval Forces, the precursor to the Royal Australian Navy. He presented for duty at the old Williamstown Depot in Victoria. A major component of his training involved him serving aboard the rechristened monitor HMAS Cerberus, which was now moored alongside the Gellibrand Pier in Port Melbourne. Of his early time in the Naval Cadet Corps, Veal would reflect, quote, "We cadets used to go aboard the Cerberus and drill with the .45 four-barreled Nordenfeldt guns and a couple of light three-pounders that she had. Occasionally we drill with the 10-inch muzzle-loading guns in her turrets. We didn't use a projectile lock charges, but we went through all the motions of the various numbers. We didn't actually run the guns out or run them in, but we did do the 10-inch muzzle-loading gun drill," unquote. At the outbreak of the First World War, which was declared at 11 p.m. GMT on Tuesday the 4th of August 1914, and accounting for time zones, meant that the war started for Australia at 0900 Australian Eastern Standard Time, Wednesday the 5th of August. At this point, Veal was living in Albert Park in Victoria and was working for the Metropolitan Gas Company in Melbourne. As the Australian government was in near constant contact with the mother country, they knew that war was coming and was expecting the declaration to be delivered at any moment, and they'd issued orders that all German flag vessels be delayed until the declaration was received. At 0716, the German cargo steamer SS Fowles, having received word that Australia may no longer be a safe harbour for German flag vessels several days before and allegedly containing the staff from the German embassy in Melbourne, had slipped its moorings and under the guidance of Port Phillip pilot Captain M. Robinson, had intended to head for South America. For those wondering what a maritime pilot is a mariner who had specific knowledge about an often dangerous or congested waterway, such as a harbour or river mouth. They know about local details such as depth, currents, and hazards, and are invaluable for local navigation. There was unfortunately one final obstacle to cross for Fowles' freedom. That was Midshipman Veal and the naval examination vessel SS Alvina in Portsea that signalled that they were coming aboard. Fowles' master, Captain Wilhelm Kolken, thinking that his flight to safety was at an end, ordered full stop and a ladder dropped over the side. Examination vessels during warfare, which would, as the name suggests, is a vessel responsible for examining and verifying all merchant vessels and small craft entering and departing a port, they're usually lightly armed vessels with either machine guns or small cannons, and are supported by one or more shore gun batteries. A party of an officer and two seamen from Alvina made their way onto the bridge of Fowles and requested their papers for examination. The naval contingent, having exhausted whatever excuses they could manifest to delay the Fowles, at 12:30 allowed them to proceed. And as the two ships parted company and Fowles made its way towards the narrow waterway entrance of the port, known as the Heads or the Rip, and the surrounding fortifications of Fort Queenscliff and the batteries at Fort Nepean and Fort Pierce, word was received that war had been declared, and it signaled for Fowles to heave to and return to port. Midshipman Veal, aboard Alvina, upon seeing the signal flags from Fort Nepean, has given two different accounts of what happened next. In 1949, Veal reported observing a fragmented heliograph signal from Fort Queenscliff, stating that war was declared, and upon instructing Lieutenant McWilliam, who was in command of Alvina, was ordered to, quote, get Nepean to stop that German ship getting out. I immediately hoisted the International Signal Flag R, which was the examination service signal for Fort Nepean Examination Service supporting battery to bring to the vessel Fowles, unquote. However, by 1977, in his autobiography, Veal's story has changed to him informing McWilliam of the war signal and being told by McWilliam that, quote, signals from Fort Queenscliff were none of his business, unquote. Veal goes on to say that he persuaded McWilliam that the message was meant for them and that the International Signal Flag H should be hoisted to inform the examination battery that Fowles was hostile. There is also an account that the Nepean battery fired a shot across the bow of Fowles, completely independent from any actions undertaken by Alvina. Unfortunately, as a number of sources also state, the sequence of events around what is considered the first shot fired by British forces in anger during the First World War are vague to the point that the correct sequence of events are impossible to verify. That being said, most contemporary sources attribute the first shot to be given under the direction of Midshipman Veal and the H signal flag, which makes it the first shot fired in anger by British forces in the Great War. Whichever way it happened, the first shot had the desired effect. Pilot Captain Robinson immediately issued the order to the engine room of Fowles full speed astern, but was overruled by Culkin, who ordered full speed ahead. Now, there are accounts of a scuffle between the two men as they argued over control of the engine room telegraph, and whether it was physical or verbal, it came to an end when Robinson convinced Culkin that the next shot fired by Nepean would not be a warning one and go straight through the vessel. And as a result, Fowles was quickly turned around and placed under the escort of Alvina. The ship was then taken back to Portsea and the crew was detained as prisoners of war. Fowles would then go on to be pressed into service as the troop ship HMT Borara. Not to be outdone by this achievement, on the 11th of August 1914, orders were received by the Naval Examination Service and the Port Phillip Fortifications to remove any indications of any war activity. The reason was, several German merchant vessels were scheduled to arrive in Port Phillip, seemingly unaware that a state of war existed between Australia and Germany. The torpedo boat HMAS Countess of Hopetoun came alongside the Alvina, and District Naval Officer of Victoria, Captain John T. Richardson, came aboard and ordered Veal and the 6 Royal Australian Naval Reserve signalmen under his command to change out of their naval uniforms and don the civilian garb belonging to the civilian pilot crew. One of the freighters, Hobart, was entering Port Phillip late in the afternoon of the 11th, and the Alvina came alongside, and Captain Richardson, dressed in a grey overcoat and wearing a bowler hat and accompanied by Veal, boarded the vessel. Richardson then removed his bowler hat and overcoat, gave them to Veal, donned his naval cap, and pointed his pistol at the master of Hobart, informing him that he and his crew were now to be interred, and the ship was a prize of war. Veal returned to Alvina, leaving Richardson and an armed guard of naval reservists on board Hobart. What happened next with Richardson and the Hobart will be a focus of a future episode. Before we go forward, we must go back to 1883 and the publication of an article by the Sydney Morning Herald, when they published a summary of a German article which stated that as no one had yet annexed New Guinea, that it should be occupied by Germany to serve as the foundation of a future German colonial kingdom. It also highlighted that while it was, quote, within the Australian division of the world and of the tropics, unquote, it had been neglected on account of gold being found in the new Australian colonies. And as a result, Germany should make attempts to acquire the land and make use of good harbours and natural resources for trade and its supply of native labour. At the time, this article caused a sensation in the colony of New South Wales, but it was the Queensland colony that actually did something about it. With the Queensland Premier, Sir Thomas McGillwraith, requesting the Queensland Governor and the London Agent for Queensland to urge the Imperial Colonial Office to annex the island, as the islands to the northwest of Australia had already been claimed by Dutch merchant entities under the control of the Dutch East Indies in what is now modern-day Indonesia. Despite McIlwraith following the proper procedures, quote, impatient with the lack of results, on his own authority, ordered a Queensland police magistrate on March 1883 to proclaim the annexation on behalf of the Queensland government, and as a result, Queensland occupied the southeastern side of New Guinea to the east of the Dutch territorial claims in the area that it became known as Papua. Once news reached the United Kingdom of this act, they immediately refused to accept the claim, for fear of sparking an international incident of a colonial holding taking territory of their own. That was, of course, until the following year when the New Guinea Company was founded in Berlin with the express intent of colonizing the northeastern side of New Guinea, the nearby Bismarck Archipelago, and the Solomon Islands, to form the Western Pacific German Protectorates. Almost immediately, the United Kingdom acknowledged Queensland's claim and established the Protectorate of British New Guinea. Germany's territorial holdings in the area also served as safe harbors, wireless stations, and coaling stations for the German East Asiatic Squadron, which served as a direct threat to all shipping in and around Australia's territorial waters, as mentioned in my roundtable discussion with Melissa Ratliff and Ryan Day. At the outbreak of the war, the United Kingdom had already severed any German-controlled telegraph lines that ran through British-controlled territory. But due to the size of the German territorial holdings in the South Pacific, alongside the initial request for an expeditionary force to serve in Europe, the British government on the 8th of August 1914 requested the Australian and New Zealand governments also destroy any German wireless or coaling stations located throughout the South Pacific that Germany had created to service their merchant and military fleets. To that end, Australia was tasked with occupying German New Guinea and the surrounding protectorate, while New Zealand was tasked with occupying German Samoa. Almost immediately, word was spread that alongside the Australian Imperial Force, which was going to fight in Europe, a second separate force was being raised, the Australian Naval and Military Expeditionary Force, for overseas action, and Veal was one of the first to sign up to serve. On the 12th of August, Veal hurried to be outfitted in a blue cloth uniform, three duck uniforms of a khaki material, and the necessary badges, caps, covers, and uniform boots, as in 5 days' time he was bound for a train to Sydney to join the rest of the ANMEF. It was noted by Veal that the girls who worked at the Lincoln Stewart & Co. tailors left notes and well wishes in the pockets for Veal and the other midshipmen who accompanied him for outfitting. Once he was kitted out, he was also issued a short 303 MLE rifle or magazine Lee Enfield, which was the precursor to the 1904 short magazine Lee Enfield, which was issued to the Army, but was still being used by the Navy at the outbreak of the war. Veal then joined 104 fellow Victorian Naval Reservists in the Flinders Depot before they were accompanied by 80 South Australian Naval Reservists who formed No. 6 Battalion of the Naval Battalion. A portion of the South Australians were placed under the command of Veal. On the 16th of August, the Victorian and South Australian contingents departed Melbourne for Sydney, while at the same time, the Queensland contingent was departing Brisbane to join a 200-strong force being raised in Sydney. In total, 500 naval reservists and ex-sailors would serve as infantry. On arrival, the forces were sent to Cockatoo Island and joined the armed merchant cruiser HMAS Berrima and joined a 1,000-strong force of infantry raised in Sydney. This was alongside a 500-strong citizen force, the 3rd Queensland Kennedy Regiment, which was the first and technically only militia unit mobilised for the First World War. All of these forces were under the command of Colonel William Holmes, Distinguished Service Order. The infantry would be under the command of Lieutenant Colonel Russell Watson, and the naval reservists would be under the command of Commander Joseph Beresford. Despite the size disparity between the two forces, it was well documented that while the infantry volunteers were eager, they lacked any serious military experience. By comparison, the naval reservists were more disciplined, well-drilled in musketry and the use of the cutlass, had extensive experience in the use of field guns and the establishment or destruction of fortifications, which would prove invaluable in the upcoming campaign. Once Berrima was loaded, it departed Sydney on the 18th of August under the escort of the light cruiser HMAS Sydney, and then they travelled to Palm Island off Townsville, arriving there on the 24th of August, when Sydney handed off escort duties to the newly arrived HMAS Encounter. During this journey, Veal was appointed to Officer of the Quarters for the two 4.7-inch guns that had been retrofitted to the bow of the transport, turning it into an armed merchant vessel. While at Palm Island, the contingent undertook additional 10 days training while Sydney proceeded to Townsville for provisions. It had been intended that Berrima would have both Sydney and Encounter escorted to Port Moresby, where it would be joined by the SS Kanawha that was transporting the Kennedy Regiment, but with the uncertainty of the location of Admiral Maximilian von Spee's East Asiatic Squadron, commander of the Australian Squadron, Rear Admiral Sir George Patey, issued instructions that the expedition could not proceed without a strong naval escort, and thus they had to wait until the battlecruiser HMAS Australia, the cruiser HMAS Melbourne, the French cruiser Montcalm, and the Royal Navy vessels HMS Psyche, Philomel, and Piranus, who had been diverted to assist the New Zealand Expeditionary Force in capturing German Samoa, to return. For the next 10 days, the Australian forces spent their time practicing landing troops using the vessel's lifeboats on supposedly hostile shores. A rifle range was set up and musketry competitions were undertaken, with a good number of the Victorian volunteers coming out on top. On the 2nd of September, the convoy received orders to proceed to Port Moresby, where they would meet the Queensland Militia Volunteers, Colliers, and the rest of the Australian fleet. On their arrival, Colonel Holmes inspected the Kennedy Regiment and found them to, while possessing enthusiasm, lack the experience, preparedness, or equipment to be of any use in the expedition, and recommended they be sent home to return to garrison duties. Though before his order could actually be carried out, the crew of Kanawha that had transported them had mutinied, having not agreed to be sent to hostile action, and was subsequently sent back to Townsville, and thus neither party would have any further involvement in the war. On the return of Australia and Melbourne, the convoy continued to steam towards German New Guinea. While at Port Moresby, HMAS Sydney embarked a contingent of 50 naval reservists from Berrima, comprising of men of Numbers 3 and Number 6 companies. They would, in concert with the destroyers HMAS Warrego and Yarra, proceed to Herbershon on the eastern tip of German New Guinea. From there, 25 reservists would be distributed between the two destroyers and land east of the village to locate and destroy a German wireless station at Cabacol. While Sydney initially would sit out to sea in Blanche Bay to watch for von Spee's elusive East Asiatic Squadron. Once the landing was complete, Sydney would then steam to Herbershon as well and land the remaining reservists and a 12-pounder gun. As this was occurring, the destroyer HMAS Parramatta would steam into Rabaul Harbour, the seat of the government of the Western Pacific German Protectorate, to inspect its facilities to determine if it was suitable for Berrima to land the remainder of the invasion force. The battlecruiser HMAS Destroyer would also sit silent sentry at the mouth of the bay to screen for the Asiatic Squadron, but save for a picket boat searching for mines, would take no active part in the invasion. At dawn on the 11th of September, Australia would conduct the first joint force operation and first Allied invasion of German territory when 25 petty officers and men under the command of Lieutenant Roland Griffiths Bowen landed at Cabacol via a stone jetty, and they were accompanied by medical personnel from the Australian Army Medical Corps. The landing was unopposed, and an additional 10 men were landed to facilitate communication between the advance party and the beach by using line-of-sight communication. Bowen's party was making their way through the jungle towards the wireless station when, unbeknownst to the scouting party, they had actually left the main road and found themselves at the rear of the German first line of defences, comprising of 3 German soldiers and 20 native police. When the German in charge of the position was wounded during a subsequent short skirmish, the German force surrendered. The German commander was treated by Australian medical personnel and then forced to move ahead of the Australian formation to announce to his comrades that a force of 800 Australians had landed and they should surrender. In a stroke of luck, Bowen's deception worked, and word made it back to the German commander, Captain von Kluitz, that a superior force had landed, who now, believing his own garrison was outnumbered, had ordered these forces to withdraw, which saw the entire German coastal defence line collapse. By 0700, the Union Jack was raised over the settlement. Bowen, reassessing his own position, realising that any further advance was going to be contested, at 0900 sent word for reinforcements, as well as having his prisoners sent back to the beach. As the Berrima was still steaming towards Cabacol, an additional 59 men were unloaded from the complements of the destroyers, of which only about 14 were armed with rifles. The rest went ashore with cutlasses and pistols. By 10 o'clock, Bowen and his reinforcements had started to encounter Germans still defending their positions, and the first Australian service person was killed in the First World War. Able seaman William George Vincent Williams was shot in the stomach from a concealed position. The first Australian soldier was killed shortly afterwards as Medical Officer Captain Brian Colden Antill Pockley, who upon hearing that Williams had been wounded and after tending to his wounds gave his Red Cross armband to a sailor, Stoker Kemper, so that he could carry Williams to the rear, unfortunately meant that Pockley was also wounded shortly afterwards. Both Pockley and Williams were returned to Berrima, where they subsequently died of their wounds. The author of The Australians at Rabaul, S.S. Mackenzie, later wrote, quote, Pockley's action of giving up his Red Cross badge and thus protecting another man's life at the price of his own was consonant with the best traditions of the Australian Army and afforded a noble foundation for those of the Australian Army Medical Corps in the war, unquote. As this occurred, Bowen, realizing his strategic position had changed once again and determining that he needed to outflank the German positions, sent word down to the beach for more reinforcements. This time, Commander Beresford, upon receiving the request for reinforcements, put ashore the balance of Number 3 and Number 6 companies from Berrima. Beresford himself also relocated to the beach to better oversee the operation. Number 3 Company, under the command of Lieutenant Commander Charles Elwell, was sent forward to assist Bowen while Number 6 Company was held near the beach in reserve. Unlike the initial landings, they were all engaged by German snipers as they moved through the jungle, and while their advance was rapid, it was also under blistering conditions of the jungle and midday, with no wind and stifling heat, sapping energy and took its toll, while they also dealt with German defenders. They eventually linked up with Lieutenant Bowen's advance force and started steadily encountering stiffer and stiffer German resistance. Elwell assumed command of the whole force and ordered a flanking bayonet charge against the German positions and would be killed in the subsequent charge, his sword in his hand, giving him the distinction of being the first naval officer killed in the war. The Australian forces would continue to push their way towards the wireless station at Beta Parker, with No. 6 Company being sent up to continue the advance, finally reaching there at 1900 hours, where they found it abandoned and partially disassembled. By 1 a.m, Admiral Patey, commander of the Australian squadron, was informed that the station had been captured. In the official history of Australia's involvement in the First World War, the following is recorded. Quote, but opposition of a sort was not quite over. Early on the 12th, Lieutenant Bond, commander of No. 6 Company, rounded up several more natives armed with rifles and a party sent up from the base under Midshipman Veal, which reached the station at 10 a.m, encountered a good deal of harmless sniping along the way. After consultation with Colonel Holmes, Admiral Patey soon decided that the wireless station was too isolated and useless to be permanently occupied. Bond was therefore ordered to put it completely out of action and to bring back the instruments with him. This was effected by the afternoon of the 12th, and all landing parties returning at intervals to Cabacool were re-embarked aboard the destroyers and headed for Herbershone that evening, unquote. To complement the 12-pound gun landed by Sydney at Herbershone, on the 14th, the cruiser HMAS Encounter offloaded a second 12-pound gun, and this was placed under the command of Veal. These guns were used to convince the garrison of Beta Parker to surrender. According to Veal's account of the action, quote, each gun fired 6 rounds at extreme range, obtained by digging the trails in by 1 foot. This was mainly to, quote, impress the local inhabitants, unquote. It appears that the locals were impressed as they, quote, with one accord yelled, long way too much, unquote. This appears to be the only time the guns were fired, unquote. HMAS Encounter would also join the fray, firing her own battery into the nearby ridge, which was sufficient for the governor of German New Guinea to surrender on the 17th of September, with the remainder of the surviving German garrison surrendering on the 21st. Now, this is despite the fact that the Union Jack was raised over the capital of Rabaul on the 14th. Following the capture of the Western Pacific German Protectorate, Veal and the rest of the Australian Naval and Military Expeditionary Force now served as an occupation force, until February 1915, as the volunteers had only signed up for a 6-month tour. While the ANMEF would continue to provide garrison forces to German New Guinea until the end of the war, Midshipman Veal and the rest of his brothers were heading home aboard the steamer Naval. They arrived in Sydney to a hero's reception. In Veal's possession was a special souvenir, a piece of the Union Jack that had been raised at Herbershone 2 days before the official surrender. That triangle of fabric is now on display in Gallery 1, Cabinet 1, of the Australians in the Great War Gallery at the Australian War Memorial in Canberra. Veal and the rest of the Victorian contingent boarded trains and then returned to Melbourne. When he arrived, he was assigned as a naval staff officer in Port Melbourne for 4 months before being assigned to the complement of the cruiser HMAS Encounter from June, as the ship was undertaking garrison resupply and patrol duties in the Pacific. In August, Encounter was sent to Fanning Island to resupply a garrison that had been set up there to defend the wireless station, and on her departure, the vessel became to strife as recalled by Veal. Quote, our chart of the locality was dated December 1863 and did not show a reef about 200 yards off the island. The navigator was sent up into the foretop to keep a lookout for and report any hazards he observed, while the captain took over handling of the ship. The first we knew of the reef was when we bumped over it into a deep lagoon and anchored. I was sent with Langford in a skiff to find a way out. After much sounding with a hand lead line, we found a passage to open water, and the old girl made her exit and then proceeded to Fanning Island, where we anchored again in 6 fathoms at the bow and 20 fathoms at the stern. Stagings were slung under the ship, and Petty Officer Diver Lee put on a diving dress and was lowered over the side onto the stagings, which were worked along aft. Lee sent up a slate on which he had showed that our bottom was corrugated from under the bridge, then aft to a position under the mainmast. We cruised all over the Pacific in that condition until we relieved HMS Cornwall on the Banker Strait Patrol on the 10th of December 1915. On the 30th of December 1915, we entered King's Dock, Singapore, where we saw the extent of the damage to the bottom. We marvelled that the old bus had not been hauled and stranded high and dry on Johnson Island forever. It took 3 weeks at Singapore to get the ship seaworthy again. Unquote. Encounter would stay in British-controlled Pacific waters attached to the Royal Navy in response to rumours that German instigators were attempting to incite popular uprisings in British colonial holdings in the South Pacific, but would start 1916 in West Australian waters conducting escort duties, as Australia's other cruisers were engaged elsewhere. Veal would also leave the crew of Encounter on the 20th of January and join the crew of HMAS Una for 3 months, which had been previously the SMS Comet, which had been captured during the capture of German New Guinea. Una also has the distinction of being Australia's first aircraft carrier, technically. It was the first ship in the Australian squadron that embarked aircraft destined for New Guinea. The former government steam yacht was used for patrols around New Guinea, New Britain, the New Hebrides, and Malaya. Veal returned to Port Melbourne as a staff officer in March until June, when he was sent to Port Fremantle in Western Australia to serve as a naval staff officer at the rank of temporary acting sub-lieutenant. He would hold this position for the remainder of the war, and while in Western Australia, on the 2nd of December 1917, he would marry Myrtle Elvina Homewood. While the couple was in Western Australia, they also welcomed their first child, a daughter, Margaret Elvina Veal, known as Vina, on the 1st of April 1919. Veal and his new family would return to Port Melbourne in August, where he would continue to serve as a naval staff officer until the 31st of December 1919, when he would be demobilized after serving 5 years, 5 months mobilized for war service, of which a year and 2 months was spent overseas. He returned to his job at the Metropolitan Gas Company, and in 1920, he resumed ordinary service as a naval reservist, serving as the senior executive branch officer of the Royal Australian Naval Reserve, and continued to train Royal Australian Naval Reserve cadets and reservists. He also relocated to the suburb of Elwood, located within the city of Port Phillip, where he would spend the rest of his life. Like most men I've covered in the podcast who have continued to serve well after the First World War and during the Great Depression, promotions and appointments were few and far between for Veal. Save that for in 1922, when he was placed on active duty as part of the Office of Naval Intelligence and worked on naval organization. On the 7th of March 1922, the Governor-General, Lord Forster, issued Veal with a commission to full lieutenant MacDade to the 1st of July 1919. On the 12th of November 1926, the Veals would welcome their second child, a daughter, Rhonda Myrtle. She'd be followed by their only son, Richard John, born on the 18th of November 1931. In 1928, Veal would also be awarded the Volunteer Officer's Decoration, which was intended to reward efficient and capable officers of the volunteer forces who had given 20 years' service. It was also during the 1920s that he started a 75-year connection with the Elwood Club of the Victorian Life Saving Society. In 1934, he was appointed to the position of assistant organiser of the famous naval pageant of the Royal Agricultural Show. I have seen videos of modern-day naval pageants, and it definitely is an impressive display. The programme of the November 1934 Royal Show was sea shanties, sailors' hornpipes, marine drill, gun drill, fighting at sea, the growth of the Australian Navy, and an accompaniment of mass bands and the depictions of the life of Captain Cook, a full-size model of Sir Francis Drake's Golden Hind, which apparently fought a Spanish ship, an engagement between a British and French frigate during the Napoleonic times, and a modern warship's display of armaments in action, with the finale being a recreation of the Sydney-Embden encounter. The reviews on this pageant were astoundingly positive. In May of 1937, he commanded the Naval Battalion at the Coronation Review commemorating the coronation of King George VI, and as a result was awarded the Coronation Medal. The following year, Veal, at the age of 45, reached mandatory retirement age for reserve officers, and on his 45th birthday, he voluntarily transferred to the Royal Australian Naval Volunteer Reserve. The difference between what was essentially two branches of the same service was that the Royal Australian Naval Volunteer Reserve was intended to interest experienced civilian mariners to undertake naval training, so it was aimed primarily at merchant mariners and yachtsmen. The breadth of experience within the RANVR compared to the RANR, owing to previous seafaring experience, would be drawn on heavily with the upcoming Second World War. The other advantage is of the two groups is that the RANVR was considerably older as a requirement, as you couldn't be eligible for compulsory military service. In transferring from the RANR to the RANVR, Veal went from being the senior serving executive branch RANR officer to become the senior serving RANVR officer, instead of retiring as war clouds started to loom on the horizon. 8 days before the Honourable Sir Robert Menzies announced that Australia was involved in the Second World War, on the 3rd of September 1939, on the 28th of August, Veal was appointed to the post of Extended Defence Officer Bass Strait and Chief Examining Officer Port Phillip, placing him in command of all patrol vessels and minesweepers in the port approaches and the examination service at the entrance of Port Phillip. Essentially, his career had come full circle, but now, instead of being a midshipman aboard one examination ship, he was now in charge of all of them. Amazingly, the historical similarities would not end with Veal back in Port Phillip in Melbourne. History would repeat itself once again. Port Phillip, and in particular Fort Nepean, would be the site of the first shot fired by Australian forces, once again under the instruction of Richard Stanley Veal. At 1:49 a.m. on the morning of Monday, the 4th of September, 1939, Lieutenant Veal was woken with the news that a small merchant vessel, the coastal steamer SS Honoria, had approached Port Phillip, gave it its name, and then ignored all further signals from the examination vessel Acuna to heave to and be examined. Veal, unsure if Honoria was under its proper Australian commander, acted on the principle that, quote, it was better to be safe than sorry, unquote. As all Australian registered vessels had been instructed of the new wartime criteria, he ordered a shot from Fort Nepean, yes, the same battery that fired the shot across the bow of Fowles, to fire one across Honoria. The message was received, and Honoria heaved to and allowed Acuna to come alongside. The commanding officer of Honoria protested to naval authorities, stating that his ship was Australian and he didn't have to present for inspection. By all accounts, Veal was infuriated by this statement and reiterated to all other vessels, both foreign and domestic, that they would have to present themselves for inspection. On an interesting historical note, these two occasions were the only times the battery at Fort Nepean had ever fired the guns. In fact, the gun that fired both shots was actually the same gun. On the 27th of November 1939, Veal was appointed to commanding officer of HMAS Cerberus 3 in Port Melbourne. This was reflected in Veal's biography, quote, Victoria Naval District Order No. 45/1939 of 27 November 1939. Lieutenant Commander R.S. Veal, VD, RANVR, is ordered to assume command and authority over members of the Royal Australian Navy serving within the Naval Depot Port Melbourne on and from afternoon, Monday 27 November 1939, unquote. By this appointment, he became the first Reserve Naval Officer to command Royal Australian Navy Shore Depot. At the time, all Naval Reserve Depots during the Second World War were initially named HMAS Cerberus, followed by 2 through to 6. This was a similar convention that every state having a HMAS Penguin, as I mentioned in my episode about Chief Yeoman of Signals Stephen Lamont. This appointment also came with a promotion, as mentioned in his biography, and interestingly, and a reinstatement into the Royal Australian Naval Reserve, as Royal Australian Naval Reserve officers had precedence over Royal Australian Naval Volunteer Reserve, officers of equivalent rank. However, to get around the whole retirement age being 45 of the RNAR, Veal was promoted to Lieutenant Commander with an appointment as RANR Retired, with seniority backdated to the 1st of July 1927. This was intended to give him seniority and precedence over any other reserve Lieutenant Commanders based at Cerberus. Owing to the fact that naming all your Naval Reserve Depots the same can be confusing, Veal petitioned the Assistant Chief of Naval Staff, Captain Joseph Burnett, to rename the depots, giving them individual names. Veal suggested that the Naval Reserve Depot Port Melbourne be renamed HMAS Lonsdale, and it was agreed, and thus Lieutenant Commander Veal became the first commander of HMAS Lonsdale. And as an aside, as someone who has researched a number of naval personnel for the podcast and has had to decipher which shore installation they are referring to, I 100% agree with Veal's statement that naming all your installations the same could cause confusion and frustration. On the 25th of June 1940, Myrtle Alvina Veal passed away, leaving Veal a widower responsible for the care of 3 children. In September that year, Veal would be diagnosed with neurasthenia, which is still considered to be an ill-defined medical condition characterized by a lack of physical or mental energy, fatigue, headaches, irritability, and is usually associated with an emotional disturbance, for example, the death of a spouse. In antiquity, it was also a common diagnosis for shell shock, but only really attributed to officers suffering the condition. As of 2019 and the 11th edition of the International Classification of Diseases, it is no longer a diagnosable condition. It is also no longer a diagnosis in the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. In response to his diagnosis, Veal was granted 1 month sick leave, followed by 1 month of light duty. By November of 1940, he had recovered sufficiently to return to his duties. 1941 saw Veal change assignments from commander of HMAS Lonsdale to the post of Naval Recruiting Officer Victoria in April, before taking on the additional duties of Naval District Officer Victoria and Naval Liaison Officer to the Director General of Manpower in Melbourne. Japan's entry into the war only served to double Veal's workload, as on the 12th of January 1942, he was appointed to Senior Staff Officer and Staff Officer Operations on the staff of the Naval Officer in Charge, Melbourne, who was responsible for southeastern naval operations from Cape Jaffa on the southeastern coastline of South Australia to Cape Howe, the southeasternmost point of mainland Australia on the Victorian New South Wales border, and had control as far south as the South Pole. Veal's involvement in the Second World War was primarily organising the wartime movements of vessels into and out of the port of Melbourne, including a period of several days in May of 1942 when there were 42 American warships, ranging from battleships down to small auxiliary craft and minesweepers, where he was responsible for locating suitable berths alongside piers and wharfs inside the port. On the 7th of September 1943, Veal would marry Nancy Isabel Townsend, and on his one-year anniversary, Naval District Order 28 would add the title and duty of King's Harbour Master to his appointment. On the 24th of July 1944, the Veals would welcome their first child and Stan's third daughter, Isabel Esther Veal. The 11th of July 1945 would see his duties expanded to include Staff Officer Coastal Craft. 13 days later, he would also be appointed to duty at the Naval Office in Melbourne and promoted to Commander. In this role, he'd also serve as Inspector of Naval Recruiting, Chief Royal Australian Navy Officer and Royal Australian Navy Representative on the Commonwealth Re-establishment and Re-employment Committee in the Department of Post-War Reconstruction, and in that capacity he would spend 1945 and 1946 visiting each of the Naval Reserve Depots, the former Cerberuses, HMAS Lonsdowne, Victoria, HMAS Huon in Tasmania, HMAS Rushcutter in New South Wales, HMAS Moreton in Queensland, HMAS Torrens in South Australia, and HMAS Lewin in Western Australia. After 10 years, 4 months full-time service, Commander Richard Stanley Veal was officially demobilised on the 12th of January 1950. He would remain on the Royal Australian Navy Voluntary Reserve active list for officers until he was transferred to the retired list on the 4th of September 1952, completing 43.33 years active service in the Australian Navy, of which 16 years were classified as full-time. Retirement from the Navy did not mean that Veal was going to consider slowing down. He was still very active. He continued to serve as part of the Elwood Surf Lifesaving Club, reaching the position of president and life member. At the same time, he also served on the Toorock RSL Club, including holding several years as secretary. In 1953, following St Kilda Council's refusal to provide funding for a library, Veal founded the St Kilda Library Promotion Committee and served as its president. It would not be until 1971 that St Kilda would finally get a public library, but the first person through the door was Commander Veal, who borrowed a biography on politician and army officer Wilfred Kent Hughes, who himself will probably be the focus of an upcoming episode. The affectionately named Admiral Elwood, or the Duke of Elwood, was very civically active in his community, especially when in 1965, developers started building apartment buildings with little regard to infrastructure of the suburb, and he wrote letters of complaint to the council. Now, the wording of these letters of complaint to the St Kilda Council would no longer be considered acceptable in modern society, but they did show the frustration of the locals at the feeling of being ignored by property developers and the council as a whole. On the 16th of June 1979, Her Majesty the late Queen Elizabeth II appointed Commander Richard Stanley Veal a companion of the Most Distinguished Order of St. Michael and St. George for, quote, long and outstanding service of the Royal Life Saving Society and to the interests of ex-service personnel, unquote. And on the 27th of August 1980, he was appointed a life member of the Naval and Military Club Melbourne, in which he had served numerous years as Vice President and a committeeman. On Anzac Day 1984, the Veals were honoured guests of Their Excellencies the Governor-General Sir Ninian Stephen and Lady Stephen at Government House in Canberra. As he was the last surviving crew member of the Venerable Monitor, HMAS Cerberus, he was an active participant in Sandringham Council's efforts to ask the federal government in 1986 for the funds to refloat Cerberus, which had been sunk as a breakwater in 1926, so that the 117-year-old warship could be recovered, repaired, and then placed on display as a museum. 15 years prior, Veal had attempted to restore Cerberus but failed to raise the required funds. Sadly, this attempt was also unsuccessful. 1986 also saw Veal lead the Melbourne Anzac Day March. On the 13th of March that year, he and Nancy were presented to Her Majesty the late Queen Elizabeth II and Prince Philip, entitled, quote, the naval veteran who joined the Australian Naval Forces before any other living person, unquote. Commander Richard Stanley, Stan Veal, CMG, VRD, and two bars, RANR, passed away on the 29th of July 1987 at his Elwood home of ischemic heart disease at the age of 93. He was survived by his wife Nancy, son Richard, and daughter Margaret. Full naval honours were accorded at the service at St John's Anglican Church in Toorak, where the Chief of Naval Staff, Vice Admiral Mike Hudson, stated, quote, I valued Stan's friendship and his support of every aspect of the Navy's activities. His deep affection of the service and his pride in his own extraordinary contribution were obvious to us all. His presence during the Royal Australian Navy's 75th anniversary celebrations served as a reminder for all the Navy has achieved since 1911. Very much the all-rounder, he was a model of what Australians can do for the society in which they live. From the Royal Life Saving Society to the cause of returned servicemen and a host of other activities and for the betterment of his fellow Australians, Mrs. Veal and her family have the deep sympathy of every officer and sailor of the Royal Australian Navy. We will miss him very much, unquote. He was cremated at the Boyd Chapel, Springville Crematorium. And there you have it, friends. That is the life, service, and legacy of Commander Richard Stanley Veal. His life is a testament to the principle of service before self, his unwavering commitment to both his country and community through military and civic enterprise exemplifies a rare dedication that spans several decades. Veal's story reflects a life well lived, and the brine was clearly in his veins. So today we honour a true all-rounder whose contributions to Australia's military history will never be forgotten. Now, a special acknowledgement has to go out to Doug Veal for contacting the podcast and suggesting his ancestor, Commander Richard Veal, and for that he has the special executive producer credit for this episode. If you have more stories of individuals you'd like to explore, feel free to share your suggestions either on social media or by sending us an email at podcast@thedocnetwork.net. References cited this episode are The Service Record of Commander Richard Stanley Veal from the National Archives of Australia, the capture of the German lineship Hobart at Port Phillip Heads on August 11, 1914, plus the German mercantile signal book from Ahoy, Max Webb's Log Naval Maritime Australian History and More, Australia's first shot fired in a war from the Department of Veterans Affairs Anzac Portal, Shipwrecks of Port Phillip and the Rip from the Encyclopedia of Australian Shipwrecks, the biography of Commander Richard Stanley Veal from the Friends of Cerberus website, from the archives, 1914, Australia's first shot in World War I fired at Point Nepean from the Melbourne Age, Centenary of Anzac events in Victoria and commemorating the first shot of World War I from the Navy Victoria Network, HMAS Encounter, 1905-1932, HMAS Una, a workhorse, 1914, the Navy in New Guinea, 1914, SMS Comet, the RAN's first captured warship, a valuable prize in our first aircraft carrier, and Australian Naval Aviation Part 1 from the Navy Historical Society of Australia, Defence in the 20th Century from the Nepean Historical Society, World War I on the home front from the Public Record Office of Victoria, commemorating the first shot of World War I by Major Gary Rolfe, CSC, Officer Commanding, 2nd 10th Light Battery, 5th 6th Battalion, Royal Victorian Regiment, from the Royal Australian Artillery Association of Victoria, the capture of the Comet by Neville Threnfall by the Papua New Guinea Association of Australia, the Virtual War Memorial's entry on Richard Stanley Veal, the Royal Australian Naval Volunteer Reserve at the World at War website, the collection entries at the Australian War Memorial, in particular his donated uniform and equipment, as well as the piece of the Union Jack Veal souvenir at Herbershone. And midway through the working of this episode, the history section of the Royal Australian Navy's website migrated to the online newspaper archive Trove at the National Library of Australia, which was mildly infuriating, but I both used it and Trove as a whole quite a lot in the making of this episode. I was only doing my job, and the Australian Military History Podcast is made possible thanks to the generous support from each and every one of you, but especially to the members of our Armoured Emu Brigade community. Now, if you want to continue the conversation or suggest the topic of a future episode, you can do so on all our social media channels. At this point, the podcast is on everything under @IWODMJ. Links to everything are in the show description. If you want to join the Armoured Emu Brigade community, you can also do so on our Discord server. The invite link to that is on the episode description and on the podcast website, www.thedocnetwork.net. There you can find also show notes, transcripts, and photos of my various travels relocating the myriad of memorials dotted around Australia. If you like what I do here on the podcast and want to directly support the work that I do, you can either buy the podcast a one-off coffee or support us on Patreon for exclusive podcasts, interviews, and giveaways. Each cent raised goes directly into improving the podcast, from digitization of service records and the purchasing of reference material to the distribution and licensing of each and every piece of content. But the best thing you can do is rate this episode on your platform of choice, leave a review, or share it with a friend. It's the easiest way to show your support and get the show into the ears of people who need to hear it. Thanks for listening to I Was Only Doing My Job, an Australian military history podcast, a Doc Network production. This episode was recorded on the lands of the Ngunnawal people, whose elders have passed on knowledge for thousands of years, and we pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. This podcast is mostly a one-man show, with me doing the writing, researching, recording, audio engineering, and directing, with additional research done by Laurie Favell of My Silent Hero. All opinions expressed in this episode are solely those of the speaker and do not represent the opinions or views of any agency, entity, or organization. It is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Sharealike 4.0 International License. And until next time, friends, catch you then. Bye.